Are you?
It's go time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Scraptitude, Season 2, Episode 32. We got the UFC Vegas 25 recap, Fabia bones Diego's career, oh my God. John Jones is now Black Panther, Zabit, broken or afraid? The snake recoils, TJ drops out, some 215 takeaways, a UFC 262 preview, a little bit of bullshit and whatever. Stay tuned. Scrap, 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 scrap. I mean, I'm fierce, I'm mad, I'm rude, I got that pro fighter attitude. I'm in the octagon with the podcast on, let's talk about it on Scraptitude. You know I've been the best, grab my belt and begin to flex so wild I might hit the ref. We got the winner's circle segments and the 215 takeaways with Tim and Jeff. So just kick back, grab a brew, it's fight night, so you know what we have to do. Whether a power punch or a grapple move, you know we got you covered on Scraptitude. So just kick back, grab a brew, it's fight night, so you know what we have to do. Whether a power punch or a grapple move, you know we got you covered on Scraptitude. Yeah, scrap, scrap. Scrap, scrap, yeah. Scrap, 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 yeah. Scrap, 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 yeah. Scrap, scrap, scrap. Fight. Broken or afraid?
You gotta stop hating on my man. He got the spasms, dog. He got the spasms.
So he's broken.
It's life threatening.
Broken.
He need the pacemaker.
Broken.
You're lucky. You're lucky that Zabit can't fulfill his destiny. Well, let's not be so hasty. Mm. Let's not be so hasty.
Oh, I'm sure.
Let us make all haste in welcoming Scraptitude Faithful back to another episode of this here Scraptitude podcast. Mm. My name is Timothy Lewis, and I am joined today, as always,
Jeffrey Akins, folks, the man of the people.
Man of the people!
Let's go.
How are you doing today, Jeff?
I'm doing fantastic. Got to the gym this morning after a ruthless, well, not too ruthless, but ended ruthless night of fights.
Mm-hmm. Yo, so you told me in 6 months you're going to be extra swole.
Dude, right?
The yoke
swole,
to pull out.
Swole cut yoke bull 5,000.
Damn, so you're going to be looking like Dalcha Lingumumabroomba.
Yes.
I'm sorry. You know that name's impossible to pronounce. You've seen that jaw.
It's like Lumbo Biga. Some shit. I don't know.
It sounded like pasta.
Eat an African water buffalo, that's what he says.
so you're gonna be swole like that.
We're gonna be killing you. I'm not gonna be that swole. Maybe. Possibly. No, because I'm not gonna be doing all that supplement shit heavy and all
no,
that dumb
crazy. But that's
shit.
Power. You're going through like, so there's a mix of like classes that you're doing and you're just doing your own free shit too?
Yeah.
That's so. What's up. Is this a conventional gym setup or is it a little bit different?
Well, I mean, it's a combination because I'm going to different ones. The one...
it's a multi-pass, John.
Yeah, so I got the more breaded John, so I can go to all of them in the city because I was like, I'm not just going to one that's corny as fuck. I want to do what I want whenever I want. So I got the one is like a three-floor crazy modern John, like with all these amenities in it. So they got like a whole floor that's just like all these classes and shit. It's like crazy, crazy shit.
Okay.
So you got to like sign up for it. Some of them are only like six people. Like
no
they're
word.
Small. Like,
okay.
So it's not like you're in there with like 30 people. So you're like,
is that because of COVID shit or is that just an intimate setup how they
the
do
classes,
it?
Yeah.
Okay. Neat. So you're getting swole. You're getting in there, getting the workouts in. That's what's up, man. I just bought my jump rope off Amazon.
Yeah.
I had to get a new one.
15 a day, right?
I'm doing 15 minutes of jump rope in a day. Well, I can't say that because I ain't do it yet today. But
God damn it.
It is what I was doing laundry.
What do you mean?
I was doing laundry and I was doing math, okay? And everybody knows that I'm a math genius. I never thought
no,
so.
You can't be saying you was doing laundry. You can't jump rope, bro. That's not, no.
My math teacher ain't think I was a math genius. My algebra wasn't strong. But I'm a math genius now, Jeff.
Who can't jump rope and do math?
Well, I mean, that's when it all comes to me.
So
that's when I get my clarity.
And I run up to you like 2 + 2. You're just going to fall over. Like,
yeah. Well, yeah, you're going to get me off my rhythm, dog. But speaking of that, though, last night was kind of, you know, it's not conclusive. Nothing's set in stone. But last night has me a little bit shook because I underwent a new process for trying to determine probability in fights, and I was calculating some new stuff, playing with some new numbers. And it went exceedingly well in terms of like how right I was overall throughout the night. Made a few bucks. It was good in that way. I mean, I know the event didn't have a star stud cast of names, but it's nice when you're winning money on most of the fights.
Yeah.
But it made me a little worried. It freaked me out a little bit because for a second I had this flash forward into time, and I thought about Billy Beane and how he used numbers to change the game of baseball forever. And it wasn't necessarily a good thing for baseball. Like the way, and it's arguably killing the game of baseball now. And you know, whether Billy Beane was there or not, that shit was going to get done at some point because evolution happens, optimization happens. It's the way that we are. It's the way that life is. But what if MMA isn't more complicated to solve through numbers? What if it's less complicated? What if it's more rudimentary than a lot of other sports with variables that are highly predictive that aren't that advanced to calculate? What if that happens? What does that mean for how we bet on the sport, for how we interact with the sport, for how we perceive how competitive the sport is? And I'm hoping that it doesn't go the way of baseball, where it like hyper-regiments the sport and makes it like aspects of it a foregone conclusion, like you're in an active math problem instead of like in a human sporting competition. But I do hope it goes like football, where it kind of like speeds up the game and creates more scoring, and the league adopts like a more progressive mindset to how the game is perceived and therefore makes it more exciting. I don't know, but I'm hoping that it doesn't get oversimplified through what we're doing here, but we're going to do it either fucking way.
Either way. Interesting. I don't think it's... I think MMA has too many different rule sets at the moment for it to get too bogged down, because it becomes hard to determine... Like, certain strikes have effectiveness, and, when Demetrius Johnson taking his L, that, like, the way that happens wouldn't occur in the UFC. That knockdown wouldn't occur. It would change the day. Like, it would just be...
Yeah, but there's other things that contributed to that. Like, the guy, like, he got caught with an uppercut before he got caught with that knee there.
True.
And the guy that he was fighting was significantly bigger than him. And it might be as simple as knowing the age, durability, and experience, and being able to calculate those three things contextually. You might just be able to predict, be overwhelmingly right in your predictions for fights.
You probably will be. I don't know. MMA...
Because if they're within the age apex... If they have more experience against better competition, like weighted experience, strength of schedule, and they're durable, they can withstand punishment. I feel like there's not really that much else that matters. We can talk about technique or background or a lot of different things, but generally you can look at gauges of those three attributes through the numbers, and I think overwhelmingly predict what's going to happen. So that might be a little too much insight into some of the scraptitude process there, but it's a little spooky. It's a little spooky how simple some of this might be and how much we dress it up, how complicated we make it to fetishize our own intellect, our own observational capacity. I think a lot of that happens in our sport, and we overcomplicate it because there is a tremendous artistry to what happens in the cage, and it's beautiful to watch. And me and you got into this sport because we love watching cage fights, not because we're so determined to predict who is always going to win. But you know, these are just some of the thoughts that are coming across my mind.
So, do you think that this will... So what really is a odd idea for that is that these necessarily winning these fights and all this stuff, I guess that is true, but I feel as though because of the lack of strictly winning and losing and being deterministic of how far you get in mixed martial arts, I feel as though that may be a different thing that'll occur than in other sports like baseball and football. Like, no matter what happens, if you lose your playoff, if you lose the division championship, you're not going to fight, or you're not going to play in the Super Bowl. But Conor McGregor could go and win a fight, or could go and lose a fight and get another title shot off of something, just off the strength of his name alone, potentially. Well, I think that is a aspect of the sport that keeps a fresh aspect to it and potentially stops it from getting bogged down in its own data set, simply because of we have the ability to arbitrarily remove ourselves from it and just do things we like. like having Nick Diaz fight someone at almost 40 in the UFC. You know what I'm saying? Like, that has absolutely no statistical point and has no place here.
I hear you. And I do think that there's going to be discrepancies between trying to compare team sports with MMA. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit messy right there, because team sports, year over year, they have differences in who's on the team. And so when it's fighting, you're just measuring the performance of that one specific athlete, and that stays consistent, and that's the same person throughout their entire career. There's an amorphous nature to having a team. Like, there might be consistent players on that team that are consistently responsible for success, but there's moving pieces in and out, and I don't think that there's any kind of parallel that you can really represent in an individual to that. Now, what I'm saying is that a lot of people think that because it's not broken down play by play like a football or like...
What about something like tennis?
You know, I'm not keen on the analytics of tennis. But what I'm... The question that I guess that I'm posing to people out there is, what if MMA isn't less predictable by numbers? What if it's more predictable because there's actually less variables to calculate
than we expect there to be
because a lot of it might just be white noise, like a lot of the art, the stuff that's visually enjoyable for us, what we really love, a lot of that might be white noise in terms of what really matters for who wins a fight. It's just a supposition but I'm throwing out there, but it's one that's growing. Yeah, it's one that's growing in my mind. It was a seed that was planted a while ago, and the more I get into this, like, I've created a lot of data points, and I've looked at a lot of different stuff. And in doing that, you see what correlates with success. And, well, it makes my job easier if there's less points that are necessary to correlate to a success than more. Like, the more that I can boil this down, the better job that I'm doing, that we're doing. Especially in the future when we're helping people with things like probability and betting on fights. So let's get into some MMA news, shall we? Diego Sanchez was cut from the UFC, Jeff. Tough one winner. Your favorite fighter. What are your thoughts about this? And are you going to steal his heart back from Joshua Fabia?
As you know, Tim has written many letters to Diego Sanchez, pleading with him and asking with him to return to his bed, because he's the only one who really knows what he needs. But it's okay, Tim. You can project onto me all you want. But here's what's real. Diego Sanchez is fucking up. Joshua Fabia been fucking up. My man's has his old teammates pleading with him on his Instagram post and shit, which means that clearly he's not responding to them in a private manner. And obviously, our man is caught up. That video was hilarious. Not for Diego Sanchez, but for me watching it.
It's embarrassing for Diego Sanchez. I mean, he's in too deep.
Rashad Evans really hit it on the head, I think, when he made the comment. He said, I think the UFC was, he's right, the UFC knew you got, this dude is trying to build a case with you against the UFC so you guys can sue them and make money. The UFC has 50 million lawyers they pay a gazillion dollars to. They know better than that. They're like, you're cut. The night before your fight, you're trying to do what? Cut. That's the type of shit where you know that's just no games were played. Something ridiculous is happening. Sad time.
Yeah, well, it's sad because, on the one hand, you do say like, damn, how is the UFC going to do Diego like that? I mean, it's Diego fucking Sanchez.
He got his show and win money.
For better or worse, he's a legend.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Diego Sanchez has not been a UFC-level fighter over his past few. It's been hard to watch. I know he beat Mickey Gall. Mickey Gall is not a UFC-level fighter.
Nope.
There's a lot of things about ethicality you got to worry about letting Diego Sanchez go in there and fight at the UFC level. He's catching major damage. He's a prime case for CTE, and his camp is not preparing him for fight night.
So can we just acknowledge how hilarious it was when Conor McGregor texted Dana saying he should do the Diego Sanchez fight? Dana's response still purely, we should lose our license.
That is, I think that a Jake Paul MMA fight is like a Diego Sanchez MMA fight.
What about CM Punk versus Jake Paul? MMA match. Holy shit. Talk about freak show.
You know,
circus fights. I love it.
I don't even want to talk about that. Somebody, who is it? Clay, this is for you. We're not talking about that shit. You don't want to hear it. You said that it's people like us that make choices, whether or not that shit's real, whether or not that shit's popular. We're putting a pin in that one, Jeffrey. We're not talking CM Punk versus Jake Paul. That
is a real UFC fighter.
That is not happening on the Scrapitude podcast, okay?
I love it. So, all right, fuck that. Fine. Diego Sanchez versus Jake Paul.
Diego Sanchez versus Jake Paul. Let's.
All right. Anyway, let's move on.
We've mentioned his name enough times on the Scrapitude podcast. It's hilarious. We never need to do that again.
I enjoy the comedy.
But apparently he's creating an OnlyFans.
Ooh, good for Diego.
Diego Sanchez. He looks something like shit, that. Bro. I don't know what he said. It was from his Instagram caption. I don't know if he's kidding, but he said that on there. I'm wondering. What kind of shit? Well, actually, I'm not really wondering that hard. What kind of shit him and Fabio are going to put on there? The thing for thing about the situation, the way I see it is, as strange and as gullible as Diego might be, it's impossible that it hasn't crossed his mind that this dude might be a scam artist and he might be getting used. But at this point, he's in too deep. It's the sunk cost.
Like my guy fights.
Yeah. It's the sunk cost fallacy. It's like, I've already invested everything into this. I believed in it. So now I have to continue to see it through, or else I've lost everything that I've invested in. Instead of realizing, hey, I better cut this off now before I continue to dump all of these resources into this liability. But that's not how the human brain works a lot of times. It wants to show conviction, and it wants to show that it hasn't wasted itself, that it's not wrong.
Some form of accountant discovering something illegal. Fabio perhaps siphoning money in some way. That's usually how these things go. If this dude is really trying to get after Diego's, like, in a checkbook kind of way, that's usually how that type of shit's going to happen. So, I am excited for, I'm not really excited. I guess I'm glad to see Diego making, not fighting again, because clearly his head is not in the right spot. So, power to you, Diego. Don't make an OnlyFans. Dump Joshua Fabia. Get back with your friends. They miss you. And so does that poor autistic kid that you guys used to train with. That's what Rashad was also talking about or whatever. Crazy fucked up too. And you're just like, what, bro?
Well,
that's sad.
On one side of the performance spectrum, there's Diego Sanchez. And on the other side, there's John fucking Jones.
Dun, dun.
Holding 20-mile-per-hour sprints for, what,
dude,
7-10 seconds?
We're,
at 250-plus pounds?
Mm-mm-mm.
Wow. Mm-mm. Wow, man. That's what performance looks like, dude.
John Jones is about to be, like, you know, a fight for the king of the monsters at this point, as you eloquently put, because John Jones is beefing up right now. I don't know. The man is just moving now.
That's, Stipe talking about going to 250.
Yeah, Stipe trying to bulk
up. Everybody trying to be the king of the monsters. Yeah, Francis, like, has people like, oh, I gotta be bigger.
I don't know if anyone's gonna be able to stop John Jones. If he's able to move and just be strong like that and propel a frame of that size.
Well,
everyone talk about chicken legs, but chicken legs don't be moving 250 pounds 20 miles an hour off light.
Now, what's interesting to me is that two events around John Jones occurred in very close proximity to one another. One, Derek Lewis got a title shot, and immediately preceding that, John Jones dropped first-round management.
And he talked about he never talked with the $30 million number with Dana White. And
that's
said,
what
he has said. Someone been talking to you behind my back?
He did say that, and I'm not sure. This Kawa guy that runs first-round management has always seemed like something of a clown, but he also has a solid cast of fighters that, you know, that pay for his services. He's one of the bigger players in terms of MMA management agents. But John Jones dropping him, I don't have any idea where he's going to go from here, but
wherever he wants.
It looks like he was not happy with first round management's performance on his behalf as it pertains to this Francis Ngannou fight. Now Derek Lewis takes the Ngannou fight. Will he play spoiler to the John Jones Ngannou showdown that we're all anticipating?
It brings a good eye to an important piece of MMA that does not get talked about enough. Management. Young fighters and older fighters alike have to make sure that their manager has the fighter's best interest in mind. It may seem like something that's dumb or something that's useless, but you got to remember two things in prize fighting. You got to win or you got to sell. And you do really great when you can do both. So we really have to appreciate the win side. Younger fighters, get someone who gets you the right fights at the right time so that you can get the wins when they matter. And then you get the manager who knows how to sell you to the promoter and to make sure that you get the most money out of it. And then you got to sell yourself, perform, do stuff, interact. The fight game is multifaceted. And at this point in time, like I said on the last podcast, you have to represent yourself in all these different facets. Can't leave anyone on the wayside because now it's just money on the table. People want to talk about getting Floyd checks. Floyd did a lot. He interacted. He put out videos that made people not like him. He put out the Floyd throwing money at the thing, at the camera and all that shit. Playing into your personality. And you know what? That's that Colby Covington shit. Power to him. He resurrected a dead fucking career with it. And the fact that people, you know, they kind of took it as, let me just copy him, which it wasn't the move. It's just either be, I guess, be a character if you want. But be yourself. Be something. Win. Sell. Win. Sell. Get it.
Well, a man who's not fighting and therefore can't be winning or selling is Khabib Magomedsharipov, somebody I'm notoriously high on, somebody that everybody's lying about if they say they don't like watching him
fight. He's shook. He's just shook.
You say he's shook.
He has to be shook.
If diaphragm spasms are being shook, like literally your diaphragm is shaking.
He's shook then in all the ways.
You're right. Physiologically, that's a correct diagnosis. Those close to him say he's lost motivation from the long layoff and that he's going to have surgery for the aforementioned spasms, the result of which will determine whether or not he retires. That's some heavy shit. And there's some, I mean, it's through a translator and a second party already. But this seems to be in some ways held responsible for Zabit's cardio issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So maybe he gets surgery and we see cardio's a beat. Is that a possibility? Or is he just shook for eternity?
Khabib Magomedsharipov will do anything he can to run from a 5-round fight. It is what it is. My man has now called upon the doctor squad to tell him that he can't fight because he got the shook spasms. Is your man broken or afraid, Tim? Answer me.
There is an answer, Jeffrey. It said in the same Instagram statement that said that he had lost motivation, that he could return as soon as this summer.
Oh.
So Khabib, first of all, I don't know how invasive, how intense the surgery is.
Yes, I don't know either.
We're not doctors. However, it seems as though this statement may have been made with the knowledge of Zabit's situation. Somebody close to Khabib was talking. And Khabib has been angling for a title shot or some premier type of opportunity. I think he deserves it. He's on a winning streak. He's a fantastic talent. And it's not his fault. Yair. He might have been in Zaire, fleeing the country, going everywhere he could.
Oh, yeah, right.
Dipping USADA, catching suspensions, anything and everything to not fight Khabib Magomedsharipov. I hope this ain't the end. We all just had a similar scare with Khamzat Chimaev. And when it comes to talent in the sport, I don't care what people think or what their perceived flaws are. We want to see him perform. Zabit's in that basket. I think you like to see Zabit fight. I like to see Zabit fight. No matter what, get him in that fucking octagon again. Mm. Dana, fly him to the special witch doctors that you put Khamzat through. Get his heart right. Get his diaphragm right. Have that man's cardio on fleek. Let's go.
The witch doctors that fixed Khamzat were the dictator of Chechnya coming and threatening his life and his family, most likely.
That's possible, but he was also getting like the heavy steroids and the next level plasmas.
The dictator of the country where your family comes out and says, you're confused and you will be fighting again. You were confused and you will be fighting again.
How wild would it be if Khamzat comes back and he gasses crazy in like 40 seconds?
Dude, his lungs could be ripped to shreds, dude. For real, for real.
It's that is crazy. True, because even if you get over it, guys talk about like, basketball players. Jason Tatum's one of the ones he talks about, and he's a rising star in the NBA. Just dropped 60 points the other night. Fuck him. He's with Boston. Fuck him. Fuck him. Fuck you, Jason Tatum. But he's kind of nice. And he talked about it. It took him a long time to get right. And that's the thing is these guys that get it. I'm a little worried for Volkanovski. Dudes that have serious symptoms that are coughing up blood and shit like that. You have lung scarring that even once you're fully over the virus, that shit'll take time. It takes a lot of time for you to get back to 100.
One of the things that they might not be able to do because they're in competition is that they might not be able to take certain steroids and stuff that may be able to aid them in healing without being heavy out of competition. Like, that's a big deal. Like, medical steroids are a really real thing, so it's, like, crazy to think about.
But you can get doctor exemptions for things.
Hopefully so. But even still, you might not be allowed to be in competition, and you may not be able to be fighting. Like, if you have to take a steroid regimen for a year.
Oh, that's a point. I didn't think of that.
You know, that's not for those crazy. That shit would be wild.
And you just gave me the perfect transition. Speaking of steroid regimens, we've got TJ Dillashaw, and he's unfortunately had to pull out of his scheduled clash for the first week of May against Corey Sandhagen.
Mm-hmm.
Dillashaw, as we know, suffered a gash on his eyebrow from a clash of heads in training. The notes on here done by Jeffrey says, TJ on roids. I definitely can heal. He's a fraud.
Am I wrong?
So, if you're hoping for a balanced discussion leveraged in perspective and fairness, we may not get there, but that is the type of partiality that y'all Scraptitude faithful come to this podcast for. And those of you who have been with us since the early days know that we do love a nice glass of snake tears. Cheers to that.
Cheers to that, dude. Fuck that guy. He's a fucking fraud.
Fucking cool fight though. I really want to see that one.
I want to see it too. TJ's a fraud. He's on roids. How can Alistair Overeem get his face ripped off? And the doctors got that shit right in a week.
He's talking about the lip that got torn up by Jairzinho Rozenstruik. And a couple weeks later,
1 week.
Like they stapled that shit together. It looked pretty good. But it still had a ways to go. And what Jeffrey's not realizing is that just because the surface level of his skin is slightly melded, doesn't mean that that's just not going to rip right back open with one punch.
My God, dude.
That was a big thing with Tyson Fury, you remember? Yeah, from the Otto Whalen fight coming into the Deontay Wilder rematch, was worrying about that eyebrow because that shit got busted up so bad and how
within a certain amount of time.
Yep. But the thing is, that eyebrow is always going to be more prone to splitting now.
So and then why are we wasting our time? Why are we wasting our time delaying the fight if that shit already going to be prone to splitting? He's a fraud. He's on roids.
My man's got a roast beef coming out of his forehead. You try to get him in the octagon. Jesus.
He got 14 days, dog.
Hey, I kind of liked TJ Dillashaw as a dog in that fight.
Look,
here's that's what it is.
He shouldn't have dropped out right now. He should have waited. He should have, not publicly, he should have hit Dana's line and be like, yo, we're going to see how this shit looks. But if we get 2 or 3 days out from the weekend and this joint's still franken slizzled,
I don't know what you think that doctors do, but it's not like cellular regeneration. Bro, they're not transplanting a new eyebrow.
He's on roids, bro. He's definitely got the healing shit popping off.
You're okay. So we're somewhere between he's a fraud and he's a liar and he sucks and he also has Wolverine healing superpowers. Pick a lane, Jeffrey. Is he a...
He's a fraud, but...
Is he a fraud or a god? Oh, my.
Look.
Okay.
It's just the truth.
It's just the truth. Okay, so... In other news, we got the results of last night's event. That is UFC Vegas 25, Jiří Prochazka versus Dominic Reyes. This one was the banger of bangers. That banger shit bangers. Was insane. We had some other fights on this card. Giga Shikaze, you know, destroy the liver of Cub Swanson. Cutelaba versus Jacoby ended up in a split draw. Interesting decision. Jeff told me I should have bet $5 on it. I said, why didn't you bet $5 on it? Sean Strickland predictably beat Jocko. Marab got the foregone conclusion decision victory. Mm-hmm. I think there might have been plus money on that. It might have been like minus 110, something like that. But that was crisp. Wow. That shit just lit up my ears. Damn. I'm just looking at all these fights and looking at all the Johns that made me bread. Anyways, Jiri.
Dude, that the chick. How about that? Real quick, let's talk about those.
You're talking about the illegal upkick?
The illegal upkick, and before that, the other fight.
Are you talking about? Is this a lady fight?
The lady fight. So there's two fouls, and then wasn't there the one foul in the fight before that? Or was that?
No, the same fight where she got poked in the eye and her eyelid got cut, and she had. Like, she could have probably pushed it to a no contest. Mm. She was getting... That was Randa... What's her... Fucks her face? Randa Marcos. Mm. She was getting flipped all around at that point. She said, nah, let's get it. Yeah. I want a knuckle. And then she...
She kicked that bitch in the face.
She kicked her in the face. And it was legit, but... Either that was the most delayed reaction ever, or she did a double take in midair.
She did double kick her, too.
Yeah, but first kick was chest, second kick was face.
Yeah.
And you could see she kind of went backwards and... Based on her eyes, it didn't look like her eyes were, like, unfocused, like she was gone from that perspective. And it kind of looks like she caught herself and then resumed falling.
Mm.
Man, it's impossible to really know. The only people that know are her and God.
Yeah.
What really transpired there. But we are in the era of flopping. I'm reading Fightonomics right now, and one of the things they're talking about is as the stakes raise, as fighters get paid more, as these rankings become more legit, all of these things and their expenses raise, they're going to be more inclined to flop.
I told y'all, we're in the flop era.
We're in the flop era. You're right about it.
Nothing wrong with the flop era. We just had to...
There's a little bit wrong with the flop era, but no, that's understandable.
The flop era is an important part of the evolution of the sport because it's going to force us to address certain rules because it's going to start affecting the entertainment value of the sport. People aren't going to want to watch people that are flopping in certain senses. And if, God forbid, something stupid starts happening with Aljamain Sterling, and all of a sudden we have a flop champion again and again, these are the types, you know, some people really complain about that stuff and they don't like seeing it. And God forbid, what is supposed to be the game you don't play starting to become a game people are playing by flopping.
Yeah. At the same time, don't do illegal shit. Like, that was egregious... True. That was an awful and egregious foul by Randal Marcos. And it's kind of like the fighters are hyper-incentivized to flop because she got rocked with a fucking kick to the face that was illegal. Like, there could be damage that she doesn't even necessarily acknowledge in that moment.
Mm.
That's the thing. Like, fighters get hit with shit and then they come to, like, a round and a half later. Or two rounds later, Korean Zombie, when he got rocked by Brian Ortega in the second round of their fight, he says he kind of blacked out until the fifth round. Mm-hmm. Like, that happens to these dudes. Frankie Edgar is talking about. They don't really come to and gain active memory until later in the fight. So you put the fighter in these awkward positions where they have to take themselves out of the fight, and the only way they can do that is by accentuating the damage that they've received. It shouldn't be a thing.
Which is why last time we brought this up with Petr Yan and Aljamain Sterling, we brought up the importance of the fighter not being the one who's making the decision. Mm-hmm. When these fouls occur, there should be a very strict outline that should be followed by officials. You have three or so checks. Referee, doctor, fighter. The fighter isn't asked whether they can continue or not. They're asked a series of questions that determine whether they are in shape to continue. They're not asked yes or no. It's asked, can you see this? What am I doing? And then the decision is made before them.
But it's also kind of like you know how you're supposed to answer the question if you're to continue or if you're not to continue. So like you can play the game to get the fight stopped.
That's why I don't want to... It's not their fault for getting fouled. So we can't put them in a position where they are receiving all of the pressure of the moment, because that's just not fair to the person who's getting fouled in that moment. If they get fucked up and they're like, dude, I'm kind of here, but that dude just rocked the shit out of me. If I go back in, he's going to put me down.
This is the solution, Jeff. Yeah. This is the solution. They just have to DQ the person on the spot. They have to go look at it on the film. Mm-hmm. They have to determine, yes, this shot landed squarely. We don't think this fighter can continue. If that's the case, it's a DQ. If it's a soft, if they deem it to be like an inconsequential type of impact, at the discretion of the referee or a panel of referees, maybe like in the NFL or other sports, they have panels of officials off-site that review calls and give their input. Something along those lines, and then it's ruled a no contest if the fighter says, I can't continue.
Yeah.
Or if it's late into the fight, after a certain point, they judge it based off of what's available. But there just has to be a more strict way that they handle it, and the way that they are handling it, you're right. Right now, a light is being shined on this as inadequate.
It's an important... And that's why we need... The beauty of human competition is that people find way to shirk rules. And it gives you the ability to fine-tune your sport and to make it more entertaining. And I think the key is MMA has to get more aggressive. The rule set has to be set towards more aggression. I love the Pride yellow card delay things. These are the types of things we need to have. Incentivize action. We got to make these people move in. MMA violence is the only violence that matters. And we need to make sure that the rule set is honed towards the offensive fighter and not towards someone who's just going to delay things. Because this isn't who is the best at winning points. This should be who is the most entertaining and who can go out there and get the job done and put these dudes out. Because we want to see finishes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And just to touch on that very last point you made, to me, that's why... at my birthday party we had a couple weeks ago for 261, which was awesome. Awesome night. Vindication. Oh, yes. But everybody was like, wow, that card was amazing. It's one of the best cards I've seen. And to me, I was like, there's like no competitive fights on that card.
Right.
But all folks care about is drama, entertainment, and dynamic finishes. That's what people want to see. And that's something like Pride was great at. Not all their matchups would be like, here are the two most lethal elite fighters. Yes, they did have those fights, but the fights that weren't that were geared towards entertainment. It was supposed to have some kind of freak show value, some kind of stylistic quality that would be fan-friendly. And that's what UFC 261 had in spades, thanks to also a couple grotesque injuries. Let's get into some 215 takeaways brought to you by 215 Creamery. Jeff, give it to us.
215 Creamery, the best ice cream in Philadelphia. It is, without a doubt, the only thing you need to be doing with your freezer.
Handcrafted?
Handcrafted, boutique ice cream, everything made from scratch. We put all the work in. There is nothing that you will have that will be better. Your favorite ice cream, gone. Take a single bite, I dare you. And then take that phone out, dial your favorite ice cream maker, tell them, I'm sorry. But that 215 is all I need.
Is some customer service rep is going to answer and be like, what?
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 And then you bang on them.
Yeah, but then they're going to get another call. I need that 215. And then another. And then this customer service bull is like, yo, I need the 215. And then they quit their job. And then they get a better job because they upgrade their whole lifestyle by eating 215 Creamery ice cream.
It is what it is.
215creamery.com. Order yourself a pint for pickup.
A double-blind study performed by a Labrador and a Golden Retriever have proven that...
You can't be giving dogs ice cream. They're going to be pooping everywhere. And if it got chocolate in it, they're going to be fucked. So my dog. don't have a dog.
Exactly.
Well, not anymore. You fed too much ice cream.
Oh.
New ice cream flavor. Fresh Beagle.
What? Fresh Beagle.
Jeff, this first 215 takeaway is yours. I wrote it down in your honor, but you take it away.
So, we all know that thing we all look for in a fighter. When you see him out in the street and you're like, who do I think will whoop this person's ass? What do we look at? Those ears. Those ears.
The ears.
Those ears that have years of struggle of being crumpled and ripped and stabbed and poked.
Like old napkins.
Like old napkins. And what we saw with Dominic Reyes is, my man has no cauliflower ears.
Virgin ears.
And you know what that's indicative of is a lack of training in these difficult aspects that are the grueling aspects of mixed martial arts. You know what also is indicative of? No one's probably pushing him. Mm. If you don't find yourself in uncomfortable positions consistently in your training camp and you're not getting your shit beat up every day, if you don't got a Justin Gaethje for your Kamaru Usman, he may not be as sharp. You know? You need that type of work. And everyone talks about it, but I feel like if we bring this up, people are going to be upset. Like, Dominic Reyes is a crazy good. What are you talking about? All this shit. What I'm talking about is physical evidence that our man has put in years of work in grinding positions, difficult moves. And maybe he'll develop some cauliflower ears as he gets more into his MMA career. But at this point, if a man who's been kickboxing for most of his career has more cauliflower ear than you, you may have an issue at the top tier of mixed martial arts.
Yeah, that's, you know, Dominic Reyes came into the sport as something of a...
unheralded, undeserved. Sorry.
Yeah, okay. You know, I mean, he was something of a mystery. I mean, he's a hard-hitting southpaw with timing. He was fast. He's athletic. He's big.
Mm.
There's
oddly shaped.
But there's the mold of an attractive fighter there, somebody with a lot of potential. And also, I don't think that's even an untrue statement to say now about Dominic Reyes. Hmm. But the truth is, there's no replacement for Sweat Equity. I've said this before, and I'm saying it now. You need those hours in the gym. You need that blood on the mat. You need...
And not just hours. You need quality hours with quality opponents.
You need that grotesque swelling of the ears. That damaged cartilage.
Yeah.
You need that. If you're not there, if you don't have that, you are not testing yourself in the crucible. You are not uncomfortable enough to survive in the furnace of this sport.
Mm.
This sport, if you aren't putting in the hours, if you have not spent the sweat and the blood, you are going to melt in that furnace.
Mm.
That's what's happening to Dominic Reyes right now. The temperature is getting turned up against this high-level competition, and he is melting.
Quickly.
You look at Jiri's ears, motherfucker.
His shit, collie.
Motherfucker's flower. Got two sponges nailed to either side of his head.
And this speaks to, you know what? We should give props to Dominic Reyes for, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's props. He went out on his shield. I would like to see some MMA corners throw in the towel a little bit more. Dominic Reyes has been on the receiving end of two brutal finishes now. This is not the type of stuff that a young man in their career should be dealing with. You know what I'm saying? It's not the move. Clearly, Tim can't handle it either. But it's just, and I don't want to, I guess, I'll use this as this, we can get, I want to get this into my next 215 takeaway. And that's that coaches and camps matter. And that's another thing that I want to keep bringing up, dog. You can't.
Or is it that Dominic Reyes' camp doesn't matter?
Because it's like, you know what? Everyone's not going to get a Trevor Whitman who can take any hunk of shit and turn it into a fucking shiny piece of diamond. But what you're going to get, and I mean not, and he hasn't taken any hunk of shit. Like Kamara and Justin Gaethje and Rose aren't hunks of shit, but you know what I'm saying. You need someone who understands the different nuances that you have as a fighter, and you need camps that have other fighters who are similar in skill, if not better than you, or you need to bring them in to have them fight with you. You can't be expecting to come in here and just be like, yeah, I'm an athlete, I can hit hard, I got this good left hand. You know, I've been in the gym, we've been lifting hard, I've been doing my cardio. You know, everyone does that. Everyone's cut, everyone's there. You're fighting. You need those skill aspects. You need to be getting those hours in with those people that are better than you.
Even guys like Tony Ferguson that have like garage gyms and do weird shit and are off the radar with a lot of their training. Like, he's with Eddie Bravo. Like, he's introducing himself to different kinds of situations. What is going on with my mic?
Damn, you don't explode.
I don't know. Is this joint working again? Okay. Back to what I was saying. Even you take like somebody like Tony Ferguson, who has certain gifts, durability-wise, athletically, mentality-wise, etc., who largely trains himself and is off the radar. He still trains with like Eddie Bravo. He still gets exposure to different minds, different techniques. Dominic Reyes is somewhat isolated, and they were talking about it in his walkout to the fight versus Jiri. And they were commending him for staying with his camp. Like, a lot of guys will jump ship after their first loss or whatever, and I can see that. Like, you don't need to blow everything up necessarily at the first sign of your loss. But ultimately, it's you versus the world, kind of, with your camp is how it is. And so you better make sure that your camp is prepared to take on that world, that your camp is equipped with the type of personnel and experience and training partners necessary for you to succeed at the highest level. Because if you're just doing things on your own, we saw Conor McGregor, who's very talented mixed martial artist, who has achieved the heights, but got too isolated, got too comfortable, and didn't have the right people to push him. You can't
be the best fighter. You're always in the room.
At least Conor got cauliflower ears.
But Conor's also a lifelong fighter. Dominic Reyes is not. He's a man who got his start in football.
That's real. That's real, though. But that's exactly what it symbolizes, is that he has not been dedicated this his whole life. And that brings me into my point. Strength of schedule matters. Not just in terms of who you fought, but how many people you fought. The winning percentage of your opponents. That really matters. And there was a drastic difference between Jiri and between Reyes. Jiri has like three times as many professional MMA fights as Reyes. Jiri's opponents total over 160 more wins than the wins of Dominic Reyes.
Wow.
And their opponents' winning percentage is very comparable. So you look at Jiri's experience, like, he's fought tons and tons more guys, and they have a similar winning percentage. So Dominic Reyes just, he's not nearly at a level of accumulation. You kind of got to think of beating guys that are experienced as like taking XP from them, like kind of knocking the rings out of them and taking those rings for yourself. And you take more rings, you level up. And at 28 years old, Jiri Prochazka. I always call it Jiri Prochazka. But Prochazka, at 28 years old, has a lot more of those rings, a lot more of those XP points than Dominic Reyes does. Strength of schedule matters. Experience matters. Age-adjusted experience is a fucking holy grail. And Jiri Prochazka is the one sipping from that. Dominic Reyes, well, if you just looked at that metric, you'd have Jiri as a much larger favorite. And me, I thought that he was a larger favorite than was exemplified by the odds going through the numbers simply because of his strength of schedule, because of his experience and their relative ages. Jiri, he's a martial artist. He's not just roaring in the woods for aesthetics. He was born into a fighting type of lifestyle and has immersed himself within that since the beginning. He was not another sports player. He was not a ball player. He was a fucking menace who has dedicated himself to this and has just put in so many more hours. And that shined. His poise, his ability to endure. Like, he was an avalanche, and Reyes was just the person caught underneath.
Dude, and that brings me honestly to this, my next point. John Jones honestly exposed to his division the fighter that Reyes is, the limitations that he had, and the basic scaffolding to beat him as a fighter.
Good use of the word scaffolding. I like that. Paints a picture in my mind.
You know, well, it's just, it really is, because John Jones, he didn't really get the chance to dive, you know, get deep in to really paint the walls of a masterpiece.
He's literally on the scaffolding, chipping out the vulnerabilities of Dominic Reyes.
And it's a testament to the skill that John Jones has when these new, and god damn, I feel like we beat this drum to death, but every time we come up to it, it's just people are just like, no, John Jones just...
One of our most listened to episodes is the God is Blood fallacy,
and
where we go through a lot of this.
This is John Jones has the ability to take a young, athletic, up-and-comer who he has almost no information on, who's challenging him for a title shot, and the first time he's going to do it, and he took everything that this dude had been, this Dominic Reyes, as far as we're concerned, this is his first title shot. He's balls out everything he can do to win this fight. And John Jones, through nothing but honestly cunning and veteran savvy, was able to mitigate the fire that was Dominic Reyes, stay accurate with his shots, and take the, you know, really fight a fight where someone who doesn't really know what they're getting into is able to fight and still come out on top.
And that's, I thought it, like, it drew some raised eyebrows, but I thought it was one of the best performances of John Jones' career. Because cerebrally, it was really remarkable. This archetype of athletic, left-handed counterpuncher.
That puts a lot of dudes down.
Like, what do you think Conor McGregor's archetype is? Like, that parallel is really interesting now. It's actually fascinating. Now, Conor has more depth to his game. He's a more robust and developed mixed martial artist.
Yes.
But Reyes, we didn't really know the depth of his game. And the reason John Jones was where John Jones was, in part, is because of his incredible assessment of risk. When to press the gas pedal, when to not take too many chances. And in that fight, he progressively wore on Reyes. He exposed little bits and pieces and compounded upon those exploits over the course of the fight to the point where I was like, damn, if this fight went another two rounds, John would kill him. If the rematch happened, I think John
runs him.
John would kill him. But John really didn't have... He wouldn't have been thinking rationally. He wouldn't have been approaching the fight rationally if he was pressing for the finish like Jiri, or if he was approaching the fight like Jan. Both those guys used elements of the John Jones performance.
To win. One of the things that John Jones exposed that that Jan Blachowicz took crazy advantage of is the uppercut. Dominic Reyes had a very sneaky uppercut that he would use when dudes would exit the clinch on him. He caught John Jones with it. John Jones ate it because his chin's ridiculous. But Jan was able to pick up on that. And when they fought, that was a huge thing for Dominic Reyes. He was not able to hit Jan coming out of the clinch with that uppercut. And a quick read that John probably happened to John Jones for his. It's the first five-round fight this guy has been in. And we cannot say this enough, and people don't want to hear it. And it may go back to your point of boiling this shit down more than it needs to. And it's just, there are certain aspects that you need to have tape on some of these dudes. It really is as simple as the data set just isn't there. And for some, and it really, it's amazing that John Jones was able to do that, because Dominic Reyes is putting dudes out. He was putting these guys out, and John Jones was able to come in here and handle it.
I do think tape matters. I do. But I think it matters like 10%.
Not talking about tape. I'm talking about the data needs to pile up.
That's what I agree with. And the picture of Reyes, like, when I'm really adamant about this, is sample size matters. Mm-hmm. And Dominic Reyes is a low sample size fighter. He knocked out Chris Weidman to get a fucking title shot. Give me a fucking break. No pun intended. Sorry, Chris.
Poor Chris. It's all
right. But yeah, I think you're right in that. John Jones did expose Reyes, and I said this to you off air, but it was much the same as to how Ioanni and Jacek exposed Zhang Wei Li. Now, she was less risk-averse in that fight, but it was a surging fighter who was gaining a lot of popularity, a lot of momentum among the fan base. taking on their first true taste of elite competition. And that fighter rising to the occasion, in this case, Zhang Weili and Dominic Reyes, taking on John Jones and Yuanyan Jacek, they rose to the occasion. But as a result of doing that, they put everything on tape. Mm-hmm. There's no more mystery to those fighters. And now everybody can say, okay, this is the package. Now let me start concocting an antidote now that I have a full composite image of who you are.
I cannot. And the reason why this, I want to bring this up again, is because GSP talks about this when he brings up his fights against BJ Penn. He talks about the ability for them to get tape on BJ, to see the differences on him, and then to see the numbers difference. What makes BJ different? He's fast. So it's a combination of BJ's got these specific skills. You know, he lands a lot. You know, he great takedowns, a lot of submissions per minute, I'd imagine. Crazy numbers. But you also have the fact that you fought him. You now see what's happening. You have the ability to adjust to a fight. A lot of fighters don't adjust until the fight after. John Jones adjusted in the fight and won. It's just,
it's part of what makes him different. He's really the whole thing. If John Jones had one-punch knockout power, Jesus, he would probably grow blonde hair and start shooting energy from his body. he'd be a Super Saiyan.
Real shit. The man's got skills.
My last 215 takeaway brought to you by 215 Creamery. I had to talk about this guy. I never get to talk about this guy. He's supposed to fight UFC 262. Mm. I don't know what's happening, but apparently that fight's off the card.
Dun, dun, dun.
Demir Ismagulov is the best lightweight that almost nobody's heard of. I say almost nobody because the only way I found out that he was off the fight was from some obscure account. Actually, that's mean to call him an obscure account. I retweeted them. I'll give him the shout out because they did good journalism here. Here we go. Opening the Twitter bot. Twitter going bot. To my profile at Timothy E. Lewis if y'all need to follow me.
Follow us. Follow us at Scraptitude Philly. Follow me at OR215.
Yeah, make y'all some money.
My man's made a lot of money last night. You guys may be privy to some of these someday if you keep paying attention. Stay tuned to the Scraptitude universe.
Yeah, what happened? This drawing disappeared now.
Ruh-roh.
I retweeted this drawing.
There is a burp every pod.
There is a burp every... Sorry for all the dead air, guys. I know that's exactly what you want to hear. MMA Alerts. That's who said MMA Alerts. And that's the handle as well as their name, John. But they said that it's off due to undisclosed reasons per ESPN Fight Center. I don't know what ESPN Fight Center is either, where I go for the plug to get those updates.
Where y'all at?
But that explains why there's a discrepancy between Tapology and Wikipedia and the UFC website.
We need to get that sorted, UFC. You need a more direct line for what's happening.
Y'all need Demir Ismagulov to be fighting, because this man legit Itman Gulag. Like, he's thoroughbred, super fighter. He's got all the skills. He beat the brakes off of Thiago Moises, who then went and defeated, Alexander Hernandez. The lightweight who had some hype at some point or whatever. Moises looked good in that fight. Demir Ismagulov classed him. He has 3 wins in the UFC, all of which are by decision, but the guy's a good fighter. You know I like the finishers, but I don't think he's some soft bull that don't want the finish. I just think it's a matter of time.
Is he better than Ankalaev?
He's not better than Ankalaev. But the reason I say that is simply because Ankalaev has now proven himself against more guys at a higher level in his division. Mm. But I think that I'm a little worried about his size, Ismagulov. He's not like the biggest, most yoked bull. There's some husky guys in this division.
He needs to get yoked.
But he's still too big to where he couldn't be a featherweight. And he's 29, 30 years old, right? Entering the prime of his career. He's got the skills. He's got the background outside of the UFC. You watch him fight, this guy's a menace. He's a menace. And I know, Tim's not a film guy, whatever. I know what the fuck I'm saying. I'm thorough in this game, all aspects. Mm. Just because I'm a numbers genius doesn't mean I'm not a genius in all terms of the sport. Demir Ismagulov, look out for this man. Check out some of his fights on Fight Pass.
When I say, man, eyes lie, women lie. Numbers don't.
That means I don't either.
Godfather MMA Analytics.
You heard.
Shit. So, I guess we should get into some UFC 262.
262, let's go. So, should we just go in the order that you've listed these fights, which is not chronological?
It's not. Well, it's the three. It's the top three fights.
It's the scrap order. It's the top three fights. And, this is technically the headliner, isn't it?
Mm-mm.
Michael Chandler versus Charles Oliveira. So, we'll talk about that one first. Okay, so Jeff, he made like half of this show sheet, and it shows because my notes. Well, no, I'm not in a bad way, but my notes are pretty straightforward. It's because it's like, here's what we're talking about. And then Jeff's notes are kind of like, here's what I'm talking about. And so Jeff wrote as his first bullet point for Michael Chandler versus Charles Oliveira.
Before you even say it, this is an amalgamation of a conversation we both had.
Sure. you got to understand, like, there's various ways that I express myself when it comes to mixed martial arts, and I can be with the foolsies, I can be with the narratives, I can have fun with it.
Bro, hold on. Did we not see Yuri Prochazka basically, Prochazka, stand up at a full mount? He literally just stood up.
Okay, yeah, no, you're right, jiu-jitsu's fake. I agree. Jiu-jitsu's fake. You're right. That's 100%
continue.
True.
All right, I'm sorry.
So Jeff's bullet point is pressure and competitive spirit versus fake BJJ.
This is a legitimate feeling of the second one.
And then, the second bullet point is that these two guys don't seem like they're the two best lightweights in the world fighting.
I can't help but feel it.
You just don't get that vibe. I mean, Michael Chandler's coming in at 35 years old. Beating Dan Hooker, who's like, what, he had 55% win rate in the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
Not Charles really Oliveira's a contender.
Of fading Tony Ferguson.
And then, Charles Oliveira, at least he's built a win streak in this division.
Mm.
You can argue that he merits this opportunity, even if you don't think he's the best guy. That's just how it is sometimes. But Mike Chandler doesn't merit it in any way. Mm-hmm. Jiri merited a title shot after one fight. More so than Michael Chandler, when you consider his record outside of the UFC, his performances in Ryzen, and his age-adjusted performance. Mike Chandler's 35, and maybe that's why they're like, we need to get this guy in the limelight ASAP because he doesn't have that much time left.
Mm.
But when you actually consider what's impressive, what Jiri has done is much more impressive than what Michael Chandler's done.
100%.
In my opinion.
Well, Dan Hooker has never been a title contender in any real facet.
Well, he had a hell of a scrap with Dustin Poirier, but
Dustin fights down.
Dustin can fight down to his opponent, and if you're a dog, you can bring out the dog in Dustin Poirier. That's how it is, and Dustin's a dog, and he'll outdog you, but he'll make fights hard on himself, and he's also somebody that's very committed to striking. Dan Hooker's a committed striker. But anyways, we can't be in a position where we're building guys off of their best loss. That's how people got into trouble with Dominic Reyes, for example.
Colby Covington.
There you go. Colby Covington's another brilliant example of that. Michael Chandler versus Charles Oliveira, though. You think Michael Chandler's going to beat Chucky Olives?
So, yes. I just can't help but feel that. And as much as Oliveira is going to be doing well. He's got great jiu-jitsu. It worked on Tony Ferguson, but I just don't believe Tony's anywhere near as athletic as Chandler is, and Chandler isn't going to be someone who's going to find himself set in any position or anything like that.
He's somehow older than Chandler,
which is just like, what? But
Charles Oliveira, even if he beats Chandler, I'm going to be like, yo, this winning streak's kind of fake.
It's kind of fake. And you know what? We may be adding some of these contenders to the fraud good category, but we're not there yet. I just don't see how Chandler doesn't break Oliveira. He's been broken. Chandler is a hard-nosed wrestler. BJJ is fake.
Well, what do you say to Chandler's nickname, the Chandelier, calling him hard-nosed?
Well, hard-nosed is more, is that like a chin thing? I didn't think that was a chin thing.
I thought it was a hilarious nickname.
The Chandelier. I Oliveira has improved his stand-up. He may be the better of the two now at this point, but Chandler has shown a ferocity early in fights that I don't know we've seen from Oliveira, and I think that is going to be an issue for him, and that's how we saw him take that win from Dan Hooker. Hooker was just not at the same intensity level as Chandler was at the beginning of this fight.
It's kind of like the Aljamain Corey Sandhagen kind of thing, where one guy comes in and they're seething aggression and like the desire to destroy their
just
opponent.
Just like Yuri and Dominic Reyes. Yuri comes into some warrior chant, like doing fucking Ip Man wushu.
Yeah, chi manipulation.
And Dominic comes into Montel Jordan.
This is how we do it. And you're just like, did we just harmonize?
how? Like, if there was ever a precursor, Jesus Christ. Like, you gotta...
That really was, though. It's like, this guy is a thoroughbred martial artist, and this guy is a baseball player.
He's a guy who likes his jams before he plays.
That's the kind of song you listen to when you come up to hit the ball in the game. Because, you know, baseball players, when they are walking up to take their at-bat, they get their song of choice broadcasted. Mm. That's a This Is How We Do It kind of moment.
Yeah.
And MMA is just different.
It's different, because... That's not how you do it. You got knocked the fuck out.
So what if I told you, Jeffrey? What if I told you I could make you an offer you can't refuse?
An offer I can't refuse?
Yes. What if I told you that Michael Chandler is currently plus money?
Oh.
Right now, Charles Oliveira is a minus 134 on both FanDuel and DraftKings.
Mm.
My bookie odds to be determined, as are Tim's odds. This is a whole new thing, shifting the paradigm.
Ooh.
You'll get in there, but I'm going to sell that shit. I can't be giving this out for free. This is for my bread. This ain't for y'all's bread.
Unless you give us your bread, in which case you may use it for your bread.
We'll get there.
Skip.
We're fine-tuning the product, but this shit is getting elite. This shit's getting really crispy. Now, Charles Oliveira, minus 134. Mike Chandler, plus 110, plus 112. So... what that means for those who aren't into betting, you have to bet $134 on Charles Oliveira to make $100. You bet $100. If you bet $100 on Michael Chandler, you'll get $110. So that's how that math works out. Chandler 35 years old, Oliveira 31 years old. Chandler 4-1 in his last five. Oliveira 5-0 in his last five.
Mm.
Chandler 80% win. 80% finish rate in his last five.
Mm.
Oliveira, wait, am I backwards? I think I'm backwards with that.
Mm.
I am backwards with that. Oliveira 80% win rate because he's won five in a row,
finish
and
rate.
Four out of those five, all but the Tony Ferguson rate a fight are the ones that Oliveira has won by
and
finish.
And he would have finished. And I want to speak to that for 2 seconds. A lesser fighter would have been finished by Charles Oliveira in that fight. Tony Ferguson is a freak type and just does not quit. Because that armbar and shit, that's a finish, basically.
So here's where it gets funky, though, Jeff. Okay, so they both have high finish rates in their last five. Chandler 75%, Oliveira 80%. But here's where I start to question the favoritism towards Oliveira. He has an 18% loss by finish rate in his UFC career, or not his UFC career, in his career overall.
Mm-hmm.
In his UFC career, let's see here, Oliveira lost by finish rate 26%.
Ooh.
Yeah, so when he stepped up to UFC level competition, he started getting finished hard. But for the first several fights of his career were against relative nobodies, which isn't just a Charles Oliveira thing. That's a thing
he's
overall.
Been in the game
but I mean,
for a long time,
first
so.
Opponent 5-4, then 2-1, 1-0, 0-0,
this
3-2, 0-0,
like way back in the day.
Of course, 0-1, but you hear 6-2, 5-0. Like it took a long time before Charles Oliveira started fighting real people. He had a more padded record than the average fighter. So the fact that overall he still has an 18% loss by finish rate, and it's a quarter of his fights in the UFC.
It's over a quarter of his fights.
Yeah, well, I'm approximating, Jeff. I'm approximating for brevity. But what I'm saying is that really underlines volatility when it comes to betting. If you're less durable, that's representing your loss by finish rate. If you're losing more fights by finish, you're a more volatile bet.
Yeah, well, I mean,
Michael Chandler has only lost 11% of his career fights by finish.
Ooh.
He's lost 3 fights in his career by finish. We talk about him as a chandelier. He gets rocked sometimes. Well, to me, in this 155-pound division, that's just how it is. Guys hit hard enough to hurt you. They hit fast enough that you can't avoid them all. The volume's there. That's just what it is. Look at Dustin Poirier. Dustin Poirier is, you know, a god of this division, arguably the best fighter in this division right now, in the absence of Khabib Nurmagomedov. Dustin gets rocked all the time. Got rocked by Dan Hooker. Gets rocked by Justin Gaethje. Gets rocked by Eddie Alvarez. All these guys rocked Dustin Poirier. He comes out on top. I'm not sure we can totally call that indicative at this weight class of being good or bad or susceptible or whatever. If he's only lost 11% of his fights by finish, he's relatively durable, more so than Charles Oliveira.
So, well, one of the things that you always say is that you got to try and paint a picture of what's going to happen in the fight when you try to predict what's going to happen. And what you really start to picture when you look at the type of fighters that they are, the finishing percentage that happens to Charles Oliveira, what you start to picture is Michael Chandler is a man who starts quickly because he knows he can take a hit and wants to get in there and try to bully you. That's what he did to Dan Hooker. That pressure is maybe him recognizing that he needs to take that route and he needs to be the aggressor because he can take the hit. And with Charles Oliveira,
he's not exactly risk averse, though.
He's not risk averse, but that's where it becomes. But that's where it's like you're trying to paint the picture. Which of these? They're both not risk averse, but only one of them is far more susceptible to being finished.
But both, both guys are very intense. Both guys finish fights, and you know, a lot of guys that finish a lot of fights, they also get finished a lot. It's a standout type of guy, like Vicente Luque, like Brian Ortega, who have really high finish rates and almost never get finished. A lot of these guys, they lose some that way and they win some that way because they're less risk averse in their fights.
But what it does is that it makes me feel as though the storyline for this fight is going to be who's going to be the person that gets out of the gate quicker and is able to push their aggression in a more meaningful way. And Michael Chandler seems to be the one who, at least in his fight in the UFC against Dan Hooker, and what he seems to be taking this approach as he's older, is to be the more aggressive of the two. I think Oliveira is more slick and may be able to coax finishes regardless of the round because of his jiu-jitsu skill. But I feel if I was to try and build a narrative for this fight, that's the thing that I would believe is going to go.
Yeah, well, I think both these guys are guys that like to hit first, that like to break their opponent. And in general, across the UFC, there's very few guys that fight well going backwards. That most guys are best when they're attacking and when they don't have to think, when they're just reacting, when they're just fighting. And that happens best when you're the aggressor, when you're the one who's dictating what your opponent has to do. They're reacting to you. Both these dudes come forward. Both these guys are relentless. And either guy can finish the other, in my opinion. I just look at that loss by finish rate. With two guys that are going to go for it, that are going to meet in the middle, I don't think that Oliveira is going to submit Chandler. I don't think Chandler is going to submit him, but when it comes to strength and positional control, I like some elements there from Chandler. I think that Oliveira, it really is a close fight, but I like the durability, I like the power, I like the athleticism of Chandler, and that's what it comes down to me. I mean, when you look at their opponent's winning percentage, Chandler's opponent's at 80%, Oliveira's at 78%. They're both very well tested, and I can see people siding with the age-adjusted performance. There's actually more opponent wins and losses for Oliveira's opponents than for Chandler's opponents. The dude is remarkably experienced at 31 years old. My thing is, if you've been taking losses by finish, that's always around the corner again. You're above 20%, you're losing more than 1 out of 5 fights by finish. Oof.
Not a good stat.
I don't care if you're in the prime of your career, you're susceptible. And I think he's just a more susceptible, volatile commodity, even though he's on an extended winning streak. It's a fraud winning streak. That's my opinion. I'm not saying that he didn't have to win those fights, that he didn't necessarily perform well. I'm just saying against old Tony Ferguson, against mentally fragile Kevin Lee, and then 4 times against Nick Lentz or whatever, I'm just not buying it.
We'll see. But on to the next fight.
On to the next fight, which is we're going to leftover Leon Edwards versus the smartest man in MMA, Nathan Diaz. The favorite is obviously Leon Edwards. Not only is he the bigger, more athletic fighter, he's the technically more proficient. He's in the prime of his career while, as Nate's getting older. It's really hard to paint a version of this fight where Nate succeeds. And the question is, if he is to assemble some success in this fight, it's can he win in the clinch? Similar to how Bilal Muhammad did in the very limited time that we saw those two engage in those positions. Muhammad was able to turn Edwards and get his back against the clinch, bully him a little bit, didn't really materialize anything meaningful.
Yeah, his eye poked.
He did do that. Does Nate Diaz, is that the way that Nate Diaz is going to have to approach this fight? And is there really any chance of him winning this fight?
I don't know if there's much of a chance, but it's more of what is this fight going to show us about Leon that we're going to like or not like?
He has to finish him, right?
He not only has to really finish him, he kind of has to be extremely dominant in kind of every phase of the fight.
Like Masvidal was.
I can forgive him for maybe, like, if he tries to, like, just stay right in the clinch with Nate Diaz and play a boxing game with no kicks, I'm like, dude, he's taller. He's probably going to land a couple of hands on you. Nate knows how to box.
Yeah.
But if Leon doesn't play the game and he just, you know, uses his kicks while attacks Nate's legs, plays on the body.
It is going to be southpaw and southpaw. Yeah. That calf kick will be there.
And it's kind of what the point I wrote in the second. It's like, you know, is how timid is Leon going to be for the finish? You know, is he really going to pressure and be risk averse like he usually, and, you know, not pressure and be as risk averse as he usually is? Or are we going to see him try to make a statement? Because Nate is going to be throwing all the slaps, all the gamemanship. He's going to make you look bad if you're not really trying to whoop his ass. Like, that's kind of the thing.
That is true. Like, even if you're winning the fight, you're not going to gain fans or momentum in this division if Nate Diaz is talking shit and walking around following you. I don't think that could happen in this fight, though. Leon hits hard enough. He's big enough. He's fast enough. This should be surgical.
It should be.
But it really should be. Nate should be exploited badly in this fight.
But that's where I worry about if Leon is not going to be putting the press. Like, that's why I kind of say it's going to be indicative of where what we want to see in Leon and what we're not seeing from him. Because if he doesn't come out and put a show on against someone who's nowhere near his position, it sucks, but you're just, like, throwing your win streak and all this stuff down the toilet. Like, you want to... Leon's been playing these games for so long. He got the gift chance with Bilal, someone ranked lower. Now, by some fucking miracle, he has someone ranked even lower to fight and put a show out against that if he does well, he might get a title shot. It's just, like, leftover Leon can only be put in this fucking microwave so many times, bro. Like, Jesus Christ. If he doesn't come out tasting good now with this, like, Nate Diaz specialty cheese from, like, the farthest off place of 209, then I don't know what can make him taste good.
Stockton Swiss.
It works for a lot of fighters, you know?
Okay. My thing is,
I want to see him be impressive. And, like,
he has to be impressive, and this is the perfect fight for him to do it. Because what Nate's going to try to clinch him? Well, we know Leon has some good elbows in the clinch, even if that happens. Maybe he can get out-muscled, but that means what? Nate just presses him against the cage and hopes that works for however many rounds?
Yeah, right.
This is a 5-round fight. I think this is the first co-main event that's 5 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where he's going to win this that very small margin of the fight. He's going to win the whole fight. I don't see that. Nate has to sting him with something, and that's hard to do when you have a 0.3 KD rate.
Yeah.
Leon's going to be better at range, and he's going to be stronger on the ground. I don't see Nate being able to take him down. And then it's like, yeah, your jiu-jitsu might have meant something 15 years ago, Nate, 10 years ago. But nowadays, everybody's thorough on the ground. Everybody knows how to defend shit. You're not going to be working submissions down there against Leon Edwards. I don't think that's going to happen. And I don't even know if Nate has the strength and the leverage to keep him down on the ground if he gets him there.
This is really just another gimme fight for Leon Edwards, and I don't really know what is pushing Nate, I guess, to really take this. I guess he just wants the shortest potential path, and maybe he sees he can squeak a decision from Leon somehow. But at the end of the day, Leon needs to be impressive, and if he's not, we really have to start questioning why he is not performing at the level we would expect.
He's risk averse, man.
I know, but that's an issue. And we, as much as we want him to get a title shot, we can't get him in there with these dudes who are fighting top flight competition and finishing the fights.
It's that intensity thing. Yeah. It's that intensity thing we're talking about, where some guys take it to another level, like the Jiri, like the Aljamain Sterling. Like, there's certain guys that take it to another level. And Leon Edwards is a gifted fighter in a lot of ways. But you need to have that mean streak. You need to have that intensity that makes you, like, need the finish, that has you going in there in a primal type of way, a strategic animal, if you will, where you know what you have to do to win the fight, and you're going to go in there with a sense of malice and fearlessness and conviction. And I think Leon's great at playing the game, but I don't know when it takes that turning up the dial on that against these truly elite guys that have that bottomless hunger. I don't know if Leon's there, because if he was, I think he'd be getting some knockouts. I think he'd be getting some submissions. I think he would have needed a lot less of a winning streak to get a title shot.
You got to finish these fights, dude.
We got two guys that finish fights between Tony Ferguson and Beneil Dariush. This might be fight of the night.
Yes.
Some are doubting what Tony Ferguson has left in the gas tank. Others are saying Dariush is a prime Tony Ferguson right now. Do you think that Tony can return to form, or is Dariush too prepared, too tempered in the crucible?
I don't know if I would go so far as to say Dariush is Tony Ferguson in this prime. Tony Ferguson in his prime was competing against the contenders of his time period and winning the fights. So I don't know if Dariush is at that level yet. But right now, I am not too comfortable. If I'm Tony Ferguson, Dariush has shown the propensity to take a lot more damage against an opponent who is winning and still be able to turn around. I mean, a lot like Tony Ferguson, you know, in a way. But I think Tony scrambles a little bit more crazy. The Imanari rule, I don't know if Dariush has ever thrown himself into an Imanari rule in the center of an octagon as a solution to getting pieced up. But
no, he hasn't done that. That's not his thing.
I like Tony getting some boxing from Freddie Roach, and I like him trying to expand his game. It just may be too little, too late. Yep. And those attributes of Dariush being able to just walk through punches and kind of, like, still be in the heat. And he also seems to just fight at an even keel no matter what. He doesn't really seem to get that emotional. I don't know if I like this
return. He seems to like the chaos.
Yes. It's a winnable fight for Tony, though. Now, I don't want to lose that.
The one difference is that Dariush has a 21% loss by finish rate in the UFC, and Tony only has a 6% loss by finish rate in the UFC. So Dariush is a little more volatile than the odds are representing. I think they all have him as a slight favorite. A lot of people are buying Tony as washed in this fight, and I don't blame him based on how he's been dominated in the last two.
The man's got the skill set.
Yeah, for sure. It's a really intriguing bout here. It's a really intriguing bout. And do I think that boxing with Freddie Roach is going to give him the tools that he needs to win this fight? No. Either Tony has the tools overall based off of the diminished form of himself that he is here, or he doesn't.
Yes.
Dariush is on a hell of a streak, and I like confidence in a fighter. I like the fact that he's in the prime of his career. I'm taking him in this fight, but it's not close, and the odds aren't close either. What does it take, though, for Tony to get back on track here? The one difference that separates these guys is that Dariush hits 0.68 takedowns per round. Tony doesn't take guys down, 0.15 takedowns per round. 0.68 is significant. That means that if he fights a three-round fight, he's getting two takedowns.
So what I think that maybe Beneil Dariush getting a takedown because he's throwing balls to the wall and maybe needing to secure rounds. So maybe that evolves into taking takedowns to win rounds, but they matter.
Yeah, he's got a sick ground game, though, Dariush. Like, he's a really, really legit grappler.
So is Tony Ferguson.
I know that, but what I'm saying is that we just saw another guy with a sick ground game who could offensively grapple and hold position, have success, and that was Charles Oliveira, of course, against Tony Ferguson.
Well, it's going to be a long night for Tony Ferguson if he finds himself unable to control Dariush and prevent him from taking him down. Tony Ferguson obviously loves to thrive on those elbows, but it is going to be a very telling night for our man, Tony Ferguson. And Beneil Dariush has a chance to get the biggest feather in his cap. So we'll see how he performs. But it should be a good match. Three rounds is a little short.
Yeah, and I want to be clear, I don't have my official prediction yet. I still got to crunch a lot of numbers. The only fight I really crunch numbers for at all so far is the Chandler versus Oliveira fight.
Mm-hmm.
So I have more conviction in that fight, saying that I think Chandler's got it.
Mm-hmm.
But, man, that fight the variables are very interesting, considering you factor in the age, you factor in the loss by finish rate, you factor in the age-adjusted experience of Oliveira. It's confounding, but it makes me like the dog, and right now that's Michael Chandler. So there you have it. I'm probably going to put a bet on him today because I want to make sure that he still has. I want to make sure that it's still plus money. Maybe I'll put another bet on him, or a more specific bet in the oncoming days if Oliveira gets bet up and Chandler becomes more of an underdog. But I'm going to have my eye on this Oliveira versus Ferguson fight. I'm going to be running the numbers on that, as well as a number of other fights on this card. There's some good ones. There's some money to be made. So we'll stay glued to my Twitter if you're looking for any insights and any takes. That's all I can say.
Powerful.
And y'all know where my DM's at. You know, I'm a sociable guy. Like, I ain't going to answer all y'all all the time, but you have a question that intrigues me, yeah, I'll give you the time. Jeff, I'm feeling kind of tired. Maybe we could just cut this bullshit and whatever down to the second one, because we already talked about the other thing yesterday, and that's true. Our thoughts are covered, but this is a debate that is yet to be had.
True.
So, y'all, Scraptitude faithful, if you're only here for the MMA portion of this podcast, we are moving to bullshit and whatever. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review the Scraptitude podcast, especially on Apple Pods. That's where the majority of our listeners are. We need those 5-star ratings. We need those reviews. Write them up, please. Find us on Twitter at Scraptitude. Find us on Instagram at Scraptitude. Find us on YouTube at Scraptitude Philly. And smash that subscribe button. I am Timothy E. Lewis. Find me at Timothy E. Lewis on Instagram and Twitter. Just Twitter, though. Nah, y'all ain't on my Instagram. I ain't accepting your follows. Let's be real about that.
Find me on Twitter at OR215.
Okay.
Shit.
Okay, we good. Very good.
Very good.
Very good. So the landmark debate of the bullshit and whatever segment of this here podcast. Cheesesteaks versus burgers. Yesterday, my friend Ryan, check him out at Mukbang Me Good. He's got the funniest fucking mukbang videos either. He talk about paradigm shifters. Ryan is really taking something to the next level and doing, well, it's uniquely his. And if you need a laugh, if you need something to brighten up your day, if you're taking the world a little too seriously, go check out one of them videos. Mukbang Me Good. That is MukbangMeGood. Mukbang Me Good. Funny guy, but he posed this question to us. Cheesesteaks or burgers? If we have to choose one for the rest of our life, which do we pick? Jeffrey is on the cheesesteak side. I am on the burger side. However, I feel there's a couple vital questions that we have to hash out in order to determine for sure-sies which side either of us should be on. Here's my first question, Jeff. For cheesesteaks, are we saying that only chicken and beef are cheesesteaks, or can a cheesesteak be any kind of meat so long as it has cheese?
No. If we're
Is without cheese still in the cheesesteak family?
No, that's not.
It's just a steak sandwich.
It's a steak sandwich.
Okay.
It's got to be a cheesesteak.
Okay. Okay, no, so that was an important question. What about the meats?
There's different grades of cheesesteak meats. However, there have to be some form of beef. Chicken cheesesteaks, you can count them, but that is not just a cheesesteak. That is a chicken cheesesteak.
Okay. Well, see, that makes it easy for me. That I have to be on the burger side now because here's my thoughts. Like a burger, you can get more versatile with it. Like a cheesesteak, you got to have the cheese. You got to have the steak. It's got to be in the hoagie roll. Of course, with the burger, you got to have the bun. You got to have the burger. I get that. But in terms of toppings, in terms of presentation, in terms of expectation, there's a lot more that goes with the burger. I'd be with the cheesesteak if it's like you can do any kind of meat, because then a banh mi might be in the cheesesteak family. But now they're estranged cousins at best.
Well, no, because cheesesteak overall is technically a grinder.
A grinder, a hot sandwich.
A hot sandwich. If you want to talk about what a cheesesteak is, that's a different discussion. If you want to talk about a cheesesteak versus a burger, if I had to have the choice and I wanted both, I would take the cheesesteak.
Hmm. Yeah, but I'm saying if you can only ever have one from here on out.
Cheesesteak.
I would probably take the burger because, man, like cheesesteak, I love how you can do a burger like medium rare, first of all. Like you can change the meat.
I'll eat a steak. In that regard. I'll eat a real steak if I want.
That's fine. But then burgers, something about, you can get that brioche bun. You can get that, all the different kinds of buns on that, John. Last night I had a burger. That shit had a pretzel bun. Your shit had a bun made out of mac and cheese. The versatility, it's limited only to your imagination.
That was not better. I believe that the cheesesteak at the Pinnacle is one of the greatest sandwich amalgamations to ever come out of mankind.
I mean, I love cheesesteaks. I'm not going to talk shit.
It's just that at no point have I ever found myself saying no to the cheesesteak I wanted. I don't know.
If you want a cheesesteak, why would you say no to it?
Because I don't know. Look, I don't believe that. Maybe I'm just biased because I think that there are more ways to have a cheesesteak. I think the cheesesteak hoagie is one of the most slept-on fucking sandwiches you'll ever eat.
That's for real.
In your life.
I like a cheesesteak hoagie.
A pizza steak is amazing.
Yeah, I love them all. I love them all. I'm not going to be like, I could fuck up a cheesesteak right fucking now.
I feel like any topping that you add into a burger, you could most likely put on a cheesesteak. And I feel as though the artisan aspect of the cheesesteak roll, it's a thing that has been honed for decades in Philadelphia to the point where there are competing bakeries that have driven each other to crazy bread heights that make ridiculously delicious rolls. And I feel as though the gimmick of the cheeseburger roll, like a pretzel and stuff like that, it does not have the...
It's not a gimmick. It's,
no,
it's
there is...
diversity of possibilities.
Cheesesteak is a sandwich that has been crafted in an intense environment of scrutiny and competitiveness.
What do you mean burgers have not?
No, because of how far I feel as though there are so many different people competing in the burger sphere that it has been tapered down.
I can get it.
You can't get a good cheesesteak anywhere. You can get a good burger in a lot of places.
I can get a turkey burger, though. I can get a bison burger. I can get a normal burger. My burger can be stuffed with
cheese.
That's
because you're not a Puritan. I'm being a Puritan with what a cheesesteak is.
Yes, I don't have any broomstick, club, pine cone, or other type of uncomfortable instrument wedged up my butt.
So if I were to tell you that anything comprised of the long roll with the cheese, it can be considered a cheesesteak, does that change your opinion?
Well, I do think parameters matter in the debate. That's why I was asking these questions, and you framed out the debate such that you boxed yourself in this
corner. This is how I feel. I'm asking if you had all of these other options open with the cheesesteak, would you change your mind?
Well, to me, a crucial factor was, could I put the banh mi in the cheesesteak family?
You just want banh mi to be a cheesesteak.
Because they're amazing, Jeff.
If you put cheesesteak meat on a banh mi, it's a cheesesteak.
But I don't want cheese. I want it to be a banh mi, and if that's in the cheesesteak family, like if it's the Asian cheesesteak.
If it's cousin, a hot sandwich, they're grinders. They're both grinders, but a banh mi is not a cheesesteak.
Scrap two faithful, please answer for us: is a banh mi an Asian cheesesteak? And it might not be because it has neither cheese nor steak. Oh God! See, that's why I gotta go burger. Like you get limited. So you're saying like, I get that there's versatility to a cheesesteak. I do. Because I've had so many different kinds of cheesesteaks.
The cheesesteak was forged in a crucible of heat and passion that is Philadelphia. And it has produced the greatest sandwich man has ever put on this earth.
Yeah, I'm definitely torn here because I want to rock with the Philly side.
It's so good.
I love a good cheesesteak,
man. And you can't get them good anywhere else. It's a testament to the skill and the purity and the art that is the cheesesteak. You can go get a fucking burger with all the stupid bullshit on it, but if you fuck up that cheesesteak, it doesn't matter what the fuck you put on it, that shit's gonna taste like trash. I want my fine art. You can take your McDonald's drive-thru. Everyone who wants to reproduce a cheesesteak makes trash.
Now you're being kind of hyperbolic. I mean, yes, in that part of the cheese, like, other places trying to reproduce the cheesesteak. The only time that ever works is if it's people from Philly going elsewhere and making the cheesesteak.
And that's us. Then you know what? But that's power.
But what I do want to say is there's that I can flip that argument on its head.
I had a cheesesteak that tasted like a steak sandwich without you.
That's brilliant, Jeff. Happy for you.
It was delicious.
But there's a flip side of your argument. You're saying like, oh, it's been honed in Philadelphia where there's this craftsmanship and this locality and this legacy built into it. Yes, sure. But at the same time, the burger has been taken seriously all over the world at this point. There's been all kinds of influences and flair. You're on the regional scene with your shit.
Yeah,
but this is on, it's like, oh, wow, you're Cage Warriors. And now we're talking about the UFC out here.
That's because you want to take everyone who wants to put whatever they want on it and call it that what it is.
Because that gives me options. I like variety. If I have to pick one,
sure,
I want the thing that has all the options.
When you ask me this question, what I think is, when I go and, like, do I want a cheeseburger or do I want a cheesesteak? I'm going
to
take it.
Well, sometimes I do want the cheesesteak or the cheeseburger. That's not the question here. The question is, if you could only have one for the rest of your life, which would you pick? And I'm on the burger side. Sacrilegious, hang me from the Liberty Bell, do whatever. I'm the worst, but I pick burger.
That's fine. I live in Philadelphia, so I want cheesesteaks.
Me too!
So you can enjoy having burgers for the rest of your life. And you know what? Go ahead and go to Boston, and go ahead and go to New York, and go ahead and go to Dallas, and go enjoy all your cheeseburgers.
Fuck off. Fuck off.
And I'll be here rocking Philly.
I'll have a cheesesteak burger.
Ugh.
It'll probably be good.
It's probably terrible.
It'll probably be good.
It's probably terrible.
Because a burger's not confined to a certain kind of meat.
So you're telling me that you're going to pile a bunch of cheesesteak meat on a bun and put a single piece of American cheese on it and be like, bro, this is a burger.
Well, I do provolone, first of all.
Oh, I thought your burger was versatile.
What do you mean? No, well, for my cheesesteaks, I choose provolone. That's generally how I do it. Like, the people have their taste. You choose American. I choose provolone.
I choose whatever's delicious.
Yeah, well, okay. But
some cheesesteaks require different cheeses.
There you go. But I can literally, man, I feel like burgers are versatile where I can have like a cheesesteak burger and just instead of burger meat, I could have cheesesteak meat on that joint.
That's not a burger,
it's
bro.
Cheesesteak burger.
It's not a burger,
cheesesteak
bro.
Burger. Or I could have a very
so
thin little
So is a burger
patty.
Anything on a bun?
I guess not. That doesn't make sense because then like a chicken sandwich would be a burger. But you can have a turkey burger, but I guess it has to be ground meat. So I could have
ground meat formed into a patty.
Yeah, I guess that's what it is.
Okay.
But I could have cheesesteak meat on top of that.
Okay.
And it could be a really thin little patty. So I can basically eat a cheesesteak by only choosing burgers, but I can't eat burgers.
What I would
by only
say is if you took the best burger you ever found and I took the best cheesesteak I could find, the cheesesteak will be better.
I don't know. Guaranteed. I'll tell you what, Jeff. I would just be happy to have the best cheesesteak and the best burger. Honestly.
True. Can't go wrong with that.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have.
True.
And it's a good problem for y'all to have listening to an hour and 30-minute Scraptitude podcast. I hope y'all make it through. Sometimes listening to half at one time and half at another time can be good. But we bring you the best scrap analysis, the best humor, the best friendship. And we're happy to do it because we got the best audience.
True.
Thank you all so much for tuning in. Please subscribe, rate, and review. I am Timothy E. Lewis.
OR215.
No One Forgets Music. Take them out. Hey there, and welcome to the Scraptitude podcast. Scraptitude is a partner of PubSquare Media. To learn more about PubSquare Media, follow on Twitter at ThePubSquare. If you want to join the Scraptitude community, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Scraptitude, or subscribe to our YouTube account, Scraptitude Philly. If you enjoy this podcast, please take the time to subscribe, rate, and review. Thank you.